Welcome back to the second of the candidate forums of today. It's my pleasure to introduce the moderator for this session, which is Anita Shelburne, who is the editorial page editor for the Daily Progress. Anita?
Thank you. Well, again, thanks for being here. Thank you to the candidates. We look forward to a spirited but civil debate. And I believe the rules are each candidate gets 3 minutes for an opening statement. There has been a coin flip to determine who goes first. And then that order will be reversed towards the end when each candidate gets 2 minutes for a closing statement. So the order is Ms. Laufer, Mr. Harding, and Mr. Deeds. So if you would take it away.
Is this, oh, it is on. Hi, everybody. My name is Amy Laufer, and I'm the Democratic candidate for Senate District 17, which includes Eastern Albemarle, all the way out to Fredericksburg. I first want to say thank you all for being here on an afternoon, and I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the senior statesman for putting this together and the senior center for hosting us. Many times I've been here for these debates, and I've been sitting in the audience, so I'm really honored to be a candidate this year. I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. I am one of eight children, and in order for our farm to survive, each one of us kids had to work, picking stones, baling hay, and milking and feeding the cows, as well as getting good grades, and then when we were old enough, actually having a paying job. I'm proud to say that I am first-generation college graduate. It took me nearly 6 years to do it because I paid for it myself, including lots of different jobs and packing fish in Alaska for 3 summers to do it. And I say that because I'm telling you, I'm very persistent. After college, I wanted to serve our country. I went into the Peace Corps, and I was stationed outside of Kingston, Jamaica at an elementary school. And it was there that I really fell in love with education. And I can tell you, education is the foundation to a healthy society. I came back and I got a master's in education, and my first job in Virginia was teaching middle school math and science in Louisa County. I taught middle school for several years until our second child was born, and he was born with a rare medical condition. I had to make the difficult decision to stop teaching and take care of him, which has been amazing. Actually, his birthday yesterday, he's 14, but while I was staying home, somebody asked me to run for the school board. I ran for the school board. I served for 7 years on the Charlottesville School Board. I was both vice chair and chair. We had a lot of challenges, a lot of accomplishments, the highest graduation rate in our city's history. But I can tell you from my time on school board, it's really important who we elect. Elected officials make decisions that impact our everyday life. And I'm on the ballot this year because I want to have a better voice in Richmond. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Mr. Deeds? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Harding?
It's all right. Make sure this is working. Awesome. Thank you, Anita. Thank you, the senior statesman. Thank you, the center, for hosting these forums. It's very important for folks to be able to get out and hear these debates, the contrast of ideas, and, of course, the audience for coming out on in the middle of a weekday to hear from us. I'm running for office primarily because I've been watching the political climate for a very long time, and it seems as though in Richmond and, of course, Washington, D.C., but in Richmond as well, getting things done no longer seems to matter to those in office. I've noticed that they've pit us against each other, whether it be through political theater, purely partisan rhetoric, issues that both parties, both sides of the aisle realize aren't going to get solved on the floor, but they feed it into their bases in order to put people against each other. And ultimately, they do pit us against each other. So I'm running as an independent in this race. And that required me to go out and knock doors and talk to folks at the polls and primary day and talk to people in their neighborhoods to get the signatures of registered voters in the 25th district to be able to run for this office. I believe that civic discourse has fallen apart. I believe that people have turned off their ears and their minds to thinking about critical thought on the issues. It just becomes red team, blue team, right team, left team, instead of actually what matters to your neighbor, what matters to the 25th district. And that climate serves party stranglehold on the system. It serves the corporate donors down in Richmond that peddle cash and peddle campaign donations to both sides. If you look at some of the largest corporate donors, they peddle it to both parties equally, to the detriment of the people and to the detriment of our constituents. You've noticed the special interest groups can increase their power as the government grows because what they're buying becomes more influential. And ultimately, it favors career politicians who are able to build an entire career on this type of division. And so I'm running to try to eliminate that distraction, fight against it, because it's to the detriment of our civil liberties, to equal opportunities, to equal justice, and to an even playing field. There's an entire class of folks who've been underserved, several classes of folks, I should say, that have been underserved by this increasing hyperpartisan, hyperbolic, and destructive climate. And it's been building and building and building, and ultimately I'm running because I think enough is enough. I'm born and raised here in Charlottesville in Albemarle. I'll be here for the rest of my life. I've lived in about 80% of the district all of my life. I went to the University of Virginia and Washington and Lee for law school, and the places I haven't lived, I have extensive family who have a great perspective as well. This is the birthplace of American independence, and I think it's time that Virginia can take a lead and put an independent into the state Senate, into a very volatile 50-50 split, throw a independent in there to be a leverage between both parties, break that stranglehold, and ultimately leverage it on behalf of the people. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Deeds.
Thank you very much, Anita. And I would thank the Senior Center and thank you all for being here. Thank the other folks on the podium with me. You know, I've been in the Senate for 18 years. It's been the honor of my life to serve in the General Assembly. Think about it this way. 400 years ago, July 30, 1619, the General Assembly of Virginia, the House of Burgesses, met for the first time. That ought to burn something on the heart of every single one of us who call ourselves Virginians. 400 years ago, when we're still meeting, first legislative body in the Western Hemisphere, what happens in the other 49 states and in Washington is modeled after what happened here first. We still do it best. You know, and we... We're still doing it. Other people are modeled after what we're doing, and we're still using basically the same procedure. It gives me great honor to think that in those curved steps of our Capitol, giants and some not so giants, but a lot of people walked in those curvatures. They spent $205 million about 20 years ago remodeling the Capitol, but they couldn't take the footprints out of those marble steps. So it's very cool. I'm proud that I've been part of being able to get things done. We've had our disagreements, but you know, the last few years we were able to expand Medicaid, and that gave health care to more than 400,000 people, ultimately to more than 400,000 Virginians already in the first 9 months, to more than 320,000 Virginians, 30,000 of whom have accessed mental health services already through Medicaid expansion. I'm proud that we were able to raise teacher pay by 5%, the highest teacher pay increase in more than 10 years. Is it enough? No, it's not enough. But education has to remain our top priority if we are really going to be a Commonwealth of opportunity, if we're going to create opportunity in every corner of the Commonwealth. And I'm very proud of the work that goes on to rebuild our system of mental health care. You know, my goal the last few years has been to make sure that people that have need for services, when they have a mental illness, they have access to those services wherever they are in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We have a long way to go. We have a system of 40 community service boards and 10 mental health hospitals. It's been my goal the last few years to put together that system into a unit of cohesion where we can efficiently and effectively serve the Commonwealth of Virginia. We still have a lot of work to do. We're in the middle of that work right now. I'm asking for your vote to return, but today I'm looking forward to your questions.
Thank you. And it is time for the question portion of the program. We'll take questions from the audience as you all bring them forward, and there are people to collect those. Meanwhile, I'll start with one. Each of you has proposed reforms that are likely to require more state revenue or savings in state revenue at some point, whether that's education reform, mental health reform, or criminal justice reform. What adjustments do you think are needed in the state's tax policy and or budgeting in order to either generate new revenue or free up revenue for your proposals. And we'll start with Mr. Harding.
I'll note that one of the best parts about the Commonwealth of Virginia is the fact that we have a balanced budget. It's a requirement. And the day that that goes away is going to be a sad day for the Commonwealth. I'll also note that some of the policies that the Democratic Party is proposing in various ways are going to require significant revenue increases in order to pay for them. And what we've heard from candidates throughout the Commonwealth is the idea of progressive tax income taxation. And some folks have even considered and tossed around the idea of going after the balanced budget requirement altogether. These are things that are dangerous, and you should be wary of such ideas. As far as what I would do, the first place I would start is in the legalization of cannabis in Virginia, and this is why I'll note it. We spent $63 million last year arresting 29,000 people for a 20-year high of arrestees from illegal cannabis. Meanwhile, if you look at the amount of revenue that could come through a legalization, it would be over $200 million. That's a $263 million a year swing. That could be used for a lot of things, whether that's used for beds in our mental health centers, whether it's used for body cams or increasing home incarceration instead of detention for nonviolent offenders, whether it's used for substance abuse rehabilitation or increasing funding to our community services boards. There are a litany of ways that $263 million can be used. I'll also note that there are other ways that we can derive revenue without increasing taxation directly on income or corporate taxes. And plus, there's plenty of waste to go around as well that we could cut and trim.
All right. Thank you. We'll move next to Mr. Deeds.
Sure. I get around the state pretty much, and I've not heard any legitimate candidate talking about doing away with the balanced budget requirement in the state law. That's pretty much embedded, and it's not going to change. But the reality is we rely on a lot of bonded indebtedness. That's written into the code, written into the Constitution as well. Where I think we have the most room in terms of revenue or in terms of new money is in if we reconsider the tax credits that have been granted. More than $2 billion in tax credits are issued every year in Virginia. Those credits go from a lot of things that a lot of us agree with, a lot of things that make sense. For example, for a land conservation tax credit program, I was a sponsor of that bill back in 1998. It's been the most successful land conservation program in the country. But there are other tax credits that probably they haven't accomplished what they were set out to do. For example, there's a coal-related tax credit that's not increased jobs in the coal fields. Yet we spend hundreds of millions of dollars on that every year. I think we can reconsider some of those tax credits. We can probably come up with the revenue we think we need for some of the programs we want to accomplish. I think that there are, from time to time, various ideas about tax increases or tax cuts. We'll consider them when they come up, but from my perspective, the first place we look is with things that are already in the budget. We need to re-examine some of the tax credits.
Go ahead, Ms. Lauper.
Certainly, I would divide this up into the savings and new. And certainly, I've been on many panels now, so I've heard this several times, and I hate to reiterate, but yes, we need to relook at the tax credits that are given to corporations. Are they really effective? Is that what we need to be spending our money on? Also, we could talk about criminal justice reform. We know it costs about $38,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. And with our over use of, as we just heard in the last debate, this is a way to cut taxpayers' money and not be using it for that. And I will tell you, no school board is spending $38,000 a year per pupil. So this is a way that we could absolutely be getting the money that we need to be supporting, as I would say, education. And then also, at least at the minimum, decriminalizing marijuana possession in small amounts. This is another way we are using taxpayer money to incarcerate and sometimes criminalize poverty in ways that isn't good for the use of our taxpayer money. So these would be all ways that we could be looking at utilizing taxpayer money properly for things that we know will increase the economy, like investing in education, investing in broadband, investing in healthcare.
Thank you. So we have a submitted question that kind of follows up on that. The question is, the change in federal tax law in 2018 resulted in what some have called a windfall in Virginia tax revenue. So, should Virginia modify its tax law, or should the extra revenue be used for good purposes? And we'll start with Mr. Deeds on this one.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's going to be a windfall that's ongoing. We had a windfall this year, and the decision was made. I don't know that it was the best decision, but the decision was made to send refunds back to taxpayers, $110 a taxpayer, right before the election, $220 a couple. Those checks have already started coming out. I've seen a couple of them for different clients of mine in my law practice. I don't know that those windfalls, surpluses will continue. You know, the long-term revenue projections for Virginia suggest that we are going into a somewhat of a downturn. We're going to have several years where our revenues are not going to be as robust as they've been. So I certainly don't think that at this point we can, we're going to have the ability to wrap any more federal tax reform into Virginia's law.
And next, Ms. Laufer, would you take that?
Well, I think what it's important to note is that our federal deficit has increased with this change in tax law. And as Senator Deeds has said, we've gotten, $110 a person or $220 a couple. You know, the proposal originally from our governor was to actually invest it in the very things I just talked about, education, broadband, and healthcare. And we know, in my district, 25% of the district does not have broadband. Imagine to yourself going home right now and not being able to access your computer, your internet. You know, we are leaving children behind, we're leaving businesses behind. We can't expand telemedicine without broadband. And I agree that we don't know if this is gonna be a permanent tax cut. And I would say, you know, we need to be thinking about this in a more holistic way and realizing that the tax break that we just got was actually, we borrowed money for that. And in my opinion, you don't want to borrow money for something like that. That increased our federal deficit substantially. And I don't think we can count on it going forward.
Next.
Yes, I think they're both right. We're not going to see that annually. That was a one-time windfall for Virginia due to the accounting and the way that the revenues were generated. I do agree with returning the funds, though, to the taxpayers. $110 for a person or $220 for a couple is a significant amount of money. That can pay for groceries, that can pay for the utilities, that can pay for cell phone bills, that can pay for the supplies or the clothes. We're entering the fall, maybe somebody doesn't have that coat, have those clothes. I mean, $220 for families is good. It's good. And insofar as this is taxpayers' money, not the governor's money to use for whatever program he's going to choose today, it should be returned to folks, and I'm glad that it was. I'll note something, though, about the federal tax cuts that I do think Virginia should double down on, and that is the opportunity zones. The federal government created these opportunity zones that the governor then chose hundreds of them throughout Virginia. Areas where your capital gains taxes are either decreased or frozen, depending on how long you invest in these areas that could use the help. I think Virginia needs to follow that model and do our best to eliminate the tax burdens in those areas as well, as much as possible, so that Virginia can see the growth and investment, whether it be in inner city communities or rural communities that could use the help. And so that's a model that came out of the federal tax cut bill that I think that Virginia could add an extra layer to support it as well.
Thank you. So this next question also as a tax component, we'll go with Ms. Laufer first, Mr. Harding and Mr. Deeds. This is a little bit complicated. Charlottesville City Council has more flexibility to tax than our Albemarle County. So that's the tax component. And that is because of the Dillon Rule. Do you see a need to change the Dillon Rule, and why or why not? So Ms. Laufer.
Sure. So the Dillon Rule really is the state telling the localities that they have to especially with taxes, clear it through the General Assembly before they put a new tax on to any residents. And cities are different than counties. And it's not just about taxing authority, it's about a lot of other issues that we see localities want to make their own determination on. And I think it really is important that we look at the Dillon Rule and how effective is it today, and is it really as appropriate as it was when it was first brought up. So I definitely think Dillon Rule should be something that the General Assembly looks at.
All right, and then next, Mr. Harding.
I see it as a two-part question. First of all, I don't want to give Albemarle County any more creative authority to create taxes, okay? There are candidates running here in the county that say they are going to, quote, get creative in the ways that they generate tax revenue. I don't want to see that. I also don't want to see them taxing, you know, rain or taxing anything else that you can come up with. Now, insofar as the Dillon Rule is concerned, I do generally have issues in about half of what the Dillon Rule does, and this is why. I'm a small government guy. I think that local government should have more impact and more influence on your day-to-day than Richmond, and of course Richmond should have more than Washington. I think that's the way America was meant to be, and I think that the smallest government is the best government. With that being said, I don't think it's appropriate to go straight to a traditional home rule system where every county and every city has autonomy to dictate what does and can and cannot happen. You need to have some notice as to what's illegal. If someone is used to walking around and open carrying in their park in Fluvanna and they want to go with their children to go visit a park in Crozet, they need to have adequate notice that they're not going to be violating some law and get thrown into jail. If you have a get rid of the Dillon Rule and go straight to a home rule, you're going to have county by county, city by city, criminal codes, tax codes, business regulations, permitting requirements. So what I would like to see is localities being able to opt out of the state's requirements. That would eliminate the impact of unfunded mandates. It would allow for localities, if they don't want to enforce a particular thing, whether it be a crime or a regulation or a permitting requirement, they can do so in the name of budgetary, you know, constraint or civil liberties or whatever they need to, but they can't raise the ceiling as to what you're required or not allowed to do. I don't want them to impose spot-by-spot criminal codes, regulations, permitting requirements, but I do think they should be able to opt out of them.
The Dillon Rule grew out of an Iowa state court case in the 1870s, and what the Dillon Rule basically says is that localities can only do the things that the state says they can do. The Dillon Rule has been modified a number of times, and for example, a place where I favor modifying the Dillon Rule would be one that that gives local governments the ability to control firearms, carrying of firearms in the building, in public buildings or in public parks or in public permitted activities like what happened here in August of 2017. The issue with respect to taxation, cities can tax at a different things at a different level than counties can. That doesn't always reflect the changing nature of counties. You know, a county like my home is Bath County. Bath County is a very rural county and it hadn't changed a whole lot in terms of the overall makeup of the county in the last 100 years. Some of the communities have changed and there have been a variety of people moving in and out, but the taxation basically is the same as it's always been. And I don't really see a need for change. A place like Albemarle County or James City County or Henrico County or Fairfax County has seen significantly more growth. And what you might need to consider for certain urban growth counties, a certain group of counties where you've seen more growth, you might need to consider setting up a special form of government for them or a special exception for them under the Dillon Rule. But that's another debate that we've not had yet. That is something that we have to recognize the changing nature of some of our communities.
The next question, I'll give the order. Mr. Harding, Mr. Deeds, Ms. Lawford. The question is, our psychiatric hospitals are operating at near capacity. What are your ideas toward reducing the need for hospitalizations in the first place and for providing more pre-crisis preventative services in the community? And again, Mr. Harding first.
It's a very broad issue. There are a lot of ways to go about it. Insofar as the hospitals are full, we do need more beds. No matter what solutions we provide to preemptive care or making sure that folks never need to go to a hospital, we're going to need more beds no matter what. And so I mentioned one way of adding revenue to the increasing beds earlier in certain types of criminal justice reforms. I also think that we could pull some of the funding from the criminal justice system into the mental health system, because right now, if you look at the largest mental health provider in Virginia, it's the prison system, and it's a problem. We are over-incarcerating people who have mental health issues, and we need to revert some of those revenues into the mental health system and away from jail cells. So that's something I would like to do. I'll also note that we have issues with the transport system. Every sheriff I've talked to in the 25th district has explained that they have a problem right now where when a deputy goes and picks somebody up with an emergency order, they have to go and sit with them for 8 hours at any particular location that they're at. We need to reconstruct and vertically integrate the way that folks are transported and secured during these processes. And then ultimately, we need to recognize that mental health is an ongoing thing with somebody. It's a personal experience that we need to have earlier diagnoses. If we have physical education in schools, we need to have some components of mental education in schools. Our ratio, I think it's 1 to 3,000 in Virginia for a mental health service provider in our school systems. That ratio needs to come down so that folks can know earlier in their lives, whether they're battling anxiety, whether they're battling depression, whether they're battling something that may require, lifetime psychiatric help or other types of rehabilitation or help along the way. Things can compound if we don't get in front of them earlier, and I'd like to get them in our schools as
Thank
well.
Thank you. Mr. Deeds, next.
Yeah, this is something I could talk for a long time about. We have roughly 18 hospital beds for every 100,000 in terms of population. The national average is 11 hospital beds per every 100,000 population. We spend more money, nationally, states spend about 70% of their mental health dollar in the community and 30% in the hospitals. We spend a little bit more than 50% in the hospitals. The question was multiple. A lot of what Mr. Mm-hmm. Harding said is absolutely correct. We're incarcerating too many people with mental illness. We began the deinstitutionalization in 1963. We reinstitutionalized a bunch of those folks. Somewhere between 16 and 24% of the people that are in our jails and prisons have serious mental illness. And that does not include the people that have substance abuse addictions. That does not include the people who are in a crisis too often, mental health is somebody else's problem. Here, the reality is, 1 in 5 of us will have a mental health crisis in our life. 1 in 5 of us, 1 in 25 of us. About that. That's why ultimately of the 400,000 people that are gonna be eligible for Medicaid expansion, between 50 and 60,000 of those people have serious mental illness. 1 in 25 of us will have serious mental illness. So this is a significant issue. What I think we need to do instead of building more beds, because we can't afford it. We just can't afford it if we're gonna be able to provide people efficiently. We have to invest more money in community services. We've got to advance mental health, rebuild it through the DMAS, through Medicaid expansion, so we can put more money in intensive outpatient treatment and put more money in partial hospitalization programs. There are a lot of things we can do. It's an incredibly complicated and important question.
Thank you. And next, Ms. Lauper.
I agree with everything that everyone said. I think also, we also have a lack of mental health care workers, okay? And a lot of times that's because their wages are so depressed and they can't afford to live. And I would also say, if we're really looking at the spectrum of people, looking at schools and investing properly in fully funding our schools, starting with preschool, starting with the support staff that we need in the schools, we know that we have one counselor per 450 students. I mean, that's not viable. So looking at the whole spectrum, also how are we recruiting people to go into mental health services? Also, I would just reiterate, we do know that many people incarcerated have mental health illnesses, and it's such a broader issue. Focusing on support staff in our schools, I believe, and also making sure that we have more mental health care workers and providers. I think we know that we're seeing there's not enough, and part of that, I think, is because they don't get paid very much and it's high burnout. So making sure they have the right kind of environment so that they can sustain themselves. It's a multi-pronged approach, I would say.
Well, I think we're going to shift gears here for a little bit. We've had a couple of questions submitted about the environment. So I'm going to try to summarize this one, which basically says there are numerous environmental issues facing Virginia. Just to cite a few, the need to reduce greenhouse gases and rapidly convert from fossil fuels to renewable energy. The fact that DEQ does not have enough staff or funding, and the fact that we're pulling too much groundwater from our reservoirs and aquifers. So what are some of the changes to state laws, regulations, and other actions and or funding that you would support to address environmental problems? Mr. Deeds, we'd like to start with you.
DEQ was created back in the mid-90s, basically by putting together the water board, the air board, and the waste board to create a one-stop shop. The whole idea was that anybody who needed a permit for environmental work could go to one place and get their work done, and it'd be more efficient. And it would DEQ was basically paid for by permit fees. What pays for DEQ doesn't come from the general fund, except it comes from permit fees. An industry that needs a regulatory permit pays a fee, and that's what pays for DEQ. However, the permit fees have not caught up with the work. In other words, the permit fees only cover about 5%, 10% of the work, and we're having to make up the rest with general fund dollars. So I think the first thing we need to look to those permit fees. For people that operate landfills, there's a downside to all of this. It's going to increase the cost of doing business. But if we're going to do things, and we're going to expect DEQ to do things, and we are, we're going to have to find a way to pay for it somehow. So a couple of years ago, I had a couple of bills to require DEQ or allow DEQ to stop work on these pipelines when environmental erosion problems occurred. Well, the reality is the permit fees are paid by the pipeline developers. Well, those fees are not enough to cover the work. We're gonna have to step that up if we're gonna require DEQ to do more, and we ought to. You know, there are a lot of these environmental things that concern me. My youngest daughter lives in Alaska, and I would suggest that anyone who has questions about climate change visit Alaska, because there you can see more dramatically the impact of the human behavior, human conduct on climate change. It's real, it's existential, and we're going to have to take it seriously.
And we'll go to Ms. Laufer next.
So greenhouse gases, renewable energy, just want to make sure, and groundwater shortage. Mm-hmm. Actually, I didn't mention.
And DEQ.
And the DEQ. I do have a degree in geology. I did hydrogeology for the state of Wisconsin before going into the Peace Corps. So I'm very passionate about the environment, and that's part of why I want to run, because I think we need to have science people making these decisions. In terms of renewable, we know that the General Assembly passed about two sessions ago that one-third of our energy would be from renewable sources by 2030. I think that's a great first start. We do know, though, that for us to actually have that to happen, we need to improve our grid. And that has to be done, I think, with more funding and knowing that Dominion is the person or the organization that is in charge of this. I think, first of all, we have to make sure that they're not funding politicians, because regulatory board is the General Assembly. So making sure that Dominion is held responsible, improving our grid. We also know that there is a cap right now. If you have solar panels on your home or your business, you can't sell back fully the energy that you're not using. It's a capped at 1%. And we know that if we want to get to renewable, we have to allow people to sell back fully the energy that they're producing. We also have the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. That was a regional program for the Eastern Seaboard. We didn't adopt it. I think we should. We should be reducing our greenhouse gases. And in terms of groundwater, I can tell you as somebody that studied water chemistry, you know, it's so important to make sure our watershed is not polluted, because it is very, very difficult to fix that once that happens, especially with groundwater. And as I said, a lot of my district is rural. Many people are on wells, and once that happens, it's almost impossible to clean up.
Okay, thank you. We're going to run out of time before we get all our questions answered, so let's not do that. I'm going to take one more.
Can I answer?
I'm so sorry. Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer this one too. I'm going to start with the unholy alliance we have with Dominion Energy. Okay, Dominion Energy started off with their sole source monopoly of being a public utility in a good space. Okay, my grandfather was once the head of the electric workers union in Virginia, laying the grid, building the power plants throughout Virginia, and it was at a time when return on investment wasn't there to build the grid in rural areas, and so we gave them the sole source contract. Well, those days are gone. And yes, we could use a more secure smart grid, but at the end of the day, they don't need to have that monopoly. Insofar as they are given that monopoly, which they have, they need to be buying green energy that's going on the grid. Apex Energy here, a local Albemarle, Charlottesville-based green tech alternative energy company, wants to put a wind farm down in Botetourt County. They have the land for it, got all the permits for it, you know, bought the land, went jumped through all the hoops, but they can't find anybody to buy the energy. Well, guess what? Dominion needs to be buying that energy without raising your rates, because that's the type of relationship you need to have if you're going to continue to be able to use the government to do your bidding. Otherwise, go on to the private sector. As far as CO2 emissions are concerned, I'll note that the best steward of the earth are our farmers, okay? Small farmers and forestry, and these folks in rural America take care of their land, they take care of their soil, and what they're growing pulls out CO2. And, you know, for very often we talk about the emission side of CO2, and I get that, but we need to start focusing on the capture side as well. The introduction of hemp into the Virginia crop market could be the biggest boon, not just for jobs, but also for cleaning the soil. It puts nutrients back into the soil, and it pulls out on average 3 to 4 times the CO2 of the average tree. If we reforested all the areas of the earth that we've already cut down, we'd pull out 2/3 of the CO2 we've produced. Why don't we back hemp production, back reforestation, and give them tax abatements along the way?
So one more quick, I think this will be quick, environmental question. The order will be Ms. Lawford, Mr. Harding, and Mr. Deeds. Will you return Dominion donations if you have received any?
So I took the pledge not to take Dominion money, and I haven't received any money from Dominion. And I would just say that really what we've allowed Dominion to do is to control our ecological and economic future of the Commonwealth.
I have pledged not to take any money from Dominion. I will never take money from Dominion. I think Dominion as a public utility should not be able to give any campaign money, because they're determining their own ratepayers, essentially. I mean, you've got the Virginia consumer and residents over a barrel, and then you sit there and pad the lines of both parties. And because I'm a first-time candidate, they haven't come knocking on my door. But I'll note that they've come knocking on every other person's door, elected or running, multiple times in Virginia. They sent me an email last week saying we'd love to get together and talk about Dominion. I have their lobbyist phone numbers. They know I'm going to be a hostile party unless they start becoming a good actor. And to say, I know that the Democratic Party took a pledge not to take any more money from them, but that doesn't mean every Democratic elected official is not going to take money from them and then siphon it off to each other's PACs. Look at our governor. Our governor is one of the biggest lackeys for Dominion in the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia. That's the only reason he was able to withstand the KKK Klan scandal, is because they went through and did the digging on Justin Fairfax and ultimately propped up their man because they saw a threat in the LG's office. They are scared no matter what party you are, because they control Virginia. So no, I'm not taking their money, and they can go ahead and go on record that if elected, I'm going to do everything I can to make them either act right or get out of the public utility monopolistic structure.
All right, the next question.
I got that question too. I ran six times for the House of Delegates. This is the sixth time I've run for the Senate. I ran two statewide campaigns. I haven't taken Dominion money since 2016, and I'm not going to give it back. I'm not making any apologies. I'm not making any apologies for not being an independently wealthy private guy that was educated in private schools that can fund my own campaigns. I've been a guy who has to work for a living, and I've raised a lot of money over the years. Now, there's three levels of analysis. I've been criticized by certain parties for taking money from Dominion over the years. There's three levels of analysis you have to do for that money. Number one, yeah, I took over $100,000 from Dominion over the last 28 years. Number two, I took most of that money from Dominion in the years 03 to 09 when I was running for statewide office. When Dominion funds all statewide offices, they fund everybody. They give out money to just about everybody. Number three, look at my record. What you will find is that in 28 years of the legislature, I've got one of the most independent records with respect to utility regulation. Even Steve Hainer, who was an executive director of the Republican House Caucus in the early 90s and late 80s, said recently on a blog, Bacon's Rebellion blog, that I'm one of the only two people in the Senate that's been pro-consumer over the years, that's been absolutely pro-consumer. So yes, I took money, Dominion money in the past. I've not taken it since 2016. I'm not going to take it again, but I'm not giving anything back.
So the order for this question will be Mr. Deeds, Mr. Harding, Ms. Offer. What kinds of firearms regulations do you think are appropriate for Virginia to pass? And how would you work with the rest of the General Assembly to get that taken care of, Mr. Deeds?
I grew up in Bath County. I probably learned to shoot about the time I learned to read. You know, I hunted most of my childhood. I'm not an athlete, so I'd spend my afternoons in the fall of the year. Instead of it being a football practice, I'd be out shooting at birds and squirrels and rabbits. But in life, you kind of, my friend Chip Woodrum used to put it this way: I always reserve the right to be smarter tomorrow than I am today. The last gun legislation that passed the General Assembly was a bill that I carried that prevents young people that are under the age of 18 years old that have been subject to a temporary detention order from being able to purchase a gun when they're 18 years. That was a loophole in Virginia law that resulted in a tragedy up in Stafford County and almost a tragedy in Albemarle County. Once we became aware of it, we changed that law 2 years ago. I've carried bills the last 2 years to basically give, at the request of Charlottesville and Albemarle County, to give local governments the ability to control firearms in public spaces and in public assemblies. But I think there's some other things we can do. For example, states that have passed universal background checks have seen a reduction in firearm crimes. You know, we've already decided felons and people that have been subject to temporary detention orders shouldn't have firearms. We ought to have the tool to be able to make sure that those people don't get firearms. That's what universal background checks can prove. Red flag laws have been passed in 18 states. They've been shown to reduce the number of people who die by suicide by the use of a firearm and to be able to make domestic difficulties less lethal. So I think those bills will pass, and I'll support them, but there will probably be other bills too.
Mr. Harding?
The first thing I would do is I would allow those under the age of 21 who are the victims of protective orders to be able to concealed carry. They're not allowed to do that in Virginia. I represent a young woman who's 19 years old in rural Albemarle County, works on a horse farm by herself, born and raised in a family that's trained in firearms, and she has a protective order against an ex-boyfriend who was an abuser. He was found with a firearm against the law, didn't show up to court. She wants to be able to protect herself when she's walking around town, but it has to be open. She should be able to have a concealed weapons permit if she's, you know, the victim of a protective order. So that's the first thing I would do to be able to protect yourself, because the Second Amendment is a fundamental liberty to be able to defend yourself, defend your family, defend the weaker, defend your home, defend yourself against an oppressive and inefficient government. everybody thinks it's crazy to think that, oh my gosh, you're going to fight the tyranny with your guns. But in reality, it's an inefficient and ineffective government. It's Amber Geiger walking into the wrong apartment, shooting a man on his couch. That's the type of government I'm talking about. Not some giant army rolling in tomorrow. It's being able to defend yourself. I'll also note that, yes, we mentioned that felons all lose their firearm rights, but in Virginia, and I know it's federally imposed as well, but nonviolent felons have lost their firearms rights, and I have to go, and they have to pay me, I try to reduce it, to be able to go get their firearms rights back. And depending on which jurisdiction they're in, they probably won't. But nonviolent felons didn't lose their firearm rights until 1961, when a lot of racism was going down. It's one of the most racist things in the history of the United States, because you make them dependent on an over-police state in an area where the poor are disproportionately impacted by violent crime. They need to be able to protect themselves. So I would be willing to relook at that. Now, the type of gun regulations you're probably talking about, I'd be willing to look at a civil penalty for the negligent sale of a firearm without conducting a background check if the person you sold to would have otherwise failed the background check and they go off and commit a crime with that firearm. That's something I would look at.
All right, thank you.
Well, I can say I grew up in a hunting family. You know, I can say the first time my husband came home, it was Thanksgiving, there's a slew of dead animals and a lot of guns, and my husband's like, are you trying to scare me off or something? I mean, that's Thanksgiving. But I can also say my children go to school, and my son came home one night and said to me, you know, Mom, I don't think we could all fit behind the teacher's desk. And my daughter said to me, you know, Mom, every time I walk into the school, I wonder who is going to be the one that will do this. And I am, quite frankly, one of many parents that when the school calls, I do have a pang of wondering, is this it? You know, that's what's happening. We have a generation of children that are terrified, and quite frankly, many adults going to the movie theater, going to the grocery store. We're worried. We're scared. We know the majority of Americans, the majority of Virginians, want universal background checks. We know the majority of Americans, the majority of Virginians want red flag laws. When you're a family member or a person you love is in crisis, the local authority could be alerted and their weapons could be temporarily taken away. These are things that the majority of Virginians, the majority of Americans agree on. And also banning high capacity magazines. You know, we have to be honest about what our children are facing and what we are also facing. So those would be things I would be interested in.
Thank you. So we've reached the end of the question portion of the program, and I didn't get to everybody's questions. I apologize for that. Thank you for providing topics for our conversation. Thanks to the candidates. And now the closing statements will be 2 minutes each. And the order will be Mr. Deeds, Mr. Harding, and Ms. Laufer.
Can I just ask, what advice do you?
As far as I know, he didn't respond.
Okay.
That was invited, and he did not
count against me. Thank you so much. Thank you for the questions. I want you to know that service in the Senate has been an honor, been an incredible honor. I can tell you it's one of the honors of my life to be able to participate. It's something I still get goosebumps about when I go into that Capitol building to work. I thank you for that. I thank you for your questions today. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them. You know, service in the legislature, in any legislative body, is hard work. You know, we take sides. You know, we're Democrats or Republicans or independents or whatever we want to call ourselves, but we have to work with whomever is elected. Whoever, you know, what I tell people is I get to vote for one senator and one delegate, but my job is to work with whomever else is elected to try to get things done. And I think over the years, I've proven that I can be part of big things, getting big things done, and I still have big things that I have to do. You know, this mental health reform that I'm working on now is critical work that I can tell you people around the country are watching. We have their attention. We are getting things done. We are moving in the right direction, but we aren't nearly there. I've said to people in the past that mental health reform is like eating an elephant. You take a big bite and you feel satisfied, but then you look at everything else that's in front of you to do, and you realize how little you've accomplished. We have so much work to do. And I've been able to get that accomplished, even though I've been in the minority. Even though, you know, people like Rob Bell and Emmett Hanger that are close by have been partners of mine in getting that work done. We've been able to work across party lines to make sure we can move forward. We've got other things we have to work on. We have to build a commonwealth of opportunity. Everywhere in Virginia, we've got to continue to invest in education and transportation and we have to put broadband everywhere. $19 million this year is great, but that's not enough to do one county. We have to do so much if we are going to create a commonwealth of opportunity throughout Virginia. I need your help on November 5th. I ask for your vote. Thank you very much.
Mr. Harding, thank you.
I'll note that I got in this race for a lot of reasons, but I'm a criminal defense attorney by trade and something I'm very passionate about. The number one issue facing Virginians is criminal justice reform. And if you didn't hear enough about it the last hour, I'm going to give you a little spiel about it. If my opponent was going to fix a lot of the things he was talking about, he would have already fixed them. Okay? You need to realize that. 18 years in the Senate, a decade before that, at a certain point, it's just not going to get done. In our last debate in Covington, he was hesitant to recognize that cannabis needs to be legalized in Virginia. He co-patroned legislation in the 90s to ban medical marijuana in Virginia. It's that type of hesitancy that took him over a decade to realize that our gay neighbors have civil rights, that in his 1999 recorder bill, it's a page that said no special rights for gays. It took him Obergefell against Hodges to realize that gay people should be able to get married. It took him Roper against Simmons to realize that juveniles shouldn't be executed. I've already pledged that my first bill will end capital punishment in Virginia because it's time. I will also fully back the legalization of cannabis because we don't have the time, and 29,000 people next year or this year don't have the time to get arrested for something and wait for us to change our minds. It has to be done. I'll note, though, that the race that a lot of people are focusing on in Albemarle is the Commonwealth's Attorney's race. And I see interest in both candidates, but I'm a small government person who respects the Constitution, and I want to recognize that respecting your branch is appropriate. A lot of the things that candidate Hensley refers to, like ending the death penalty, mass incarceration, marijuana prohibition, cash bail, mandatory minimums, paying public defenders, I want to see automatic expungement of acquittals. I want to see community reentry focused on. All of these things need to be done at this level. You need to respect the law.
That's time. Thank you.
And vote, hopefully, on November 5th for me. Thank you.
And let's give Ms. Lawford a chance. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to say thank you all again for coming out today and to the Virginia Statesman. This might be the last time we meet here because I know the Senior Center is going to be opening their doors across town. So, you know, for me, this really isn't about politics. I want to work on solving problems that my family and families like all of us across the Commonwealth are facing. This district, actually, because I didn't get the chance, it's Eastern Albemarle, parts of Culpeper, all of Orange County, most of Louisa, half of Spotsylvania, and all of Fredericksburg. It's big, it's varied in needs, but I wanna ensure that we have access to affordable quality health care. I wanna make sure that our children are able to have a successful and great education that prepares them for their future. I wanna help expand broadband so that our children are not left behind, our business are not left behind, and I wanna make sure that we ensure that Virginia continues to have a strong economy that can benefit everyone. And I'm here today because I want to do the work. I've been to at least 3 forums and several different legislative discussions, and my opponent has never been at one of them. I'm here because I want to represent us and I want to do the work. And I humbly ask for your vote on November 5th. Thank you.
And I want to add something here, and in my role as moderator, because Mr. Harding introduced some additional topics at the end in criticism of his opponent, I would like to give Mr. Deeds
sure.
30 seconds to respond.
And I appreciate that. You know, I can't go back 28 years. I don't know about everything he just challenged me to, but you know what I will say is that, you know, H.L. Mencken said consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. My friend Chip Woodrum put it this way: I reserve the right to be smarter tomorrow than I am today. I hope that if I made mistakes in the past, I've grown past those mistakes. And I think I've shown in the last 28 years of service that I can get things done in the legislature, and I can get things done whether I'm in the minority or the majority. I can't get everything done unless I can get a majority to agree with me.
All right. Thank you. That wraps it up. I appreciate y'all coming. See you at the polls on November 5th.